Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, actually, set up in 2002 and goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on BCFM 93.2 across the city of Bristol. This week, Tom Woodhead is with me. He's been over to Israel, Palestine for something like 6 months or so, and he's back recently having found himself in jail. Also, too, looking at animal rights and the horse meat scandal. But first to Tom Woodhead. Hi, Tom. Welcome to Dialect.
Thank you.
Now, am I right? 6 months you were over there, roughly, since October last year?
It was 5.5, really, but yeah.
Okay. First of all, why did you go in the first place?
Okay. I have a history of being involved in activism around war, the Iraq war, and issues around Palestine and Israel.
Okay, so, I mean, we're at the 10th anniversary of the Iraq war at the moment. So what were your feelings about that? I mean, a lot of people are annoyed. We've had, just this week, a panorama programme looking at the whole weapons of mass destruction and where it all came from. Apparently some... this was intelligence that had come from the BND, the German Secret Intelligence Service, that there was weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and that seemed to get all the way around the world before the truth came out. But what are your thoughts about Iraq before we get into your other activism?
It was obvious, really, that there was never any weapons of mass destruction. I'm glad that's finally coming out. And today, actually, some activists in Brighton locked themselves onto an arms manufacturer to commemorate the fact that it's still a war crime 10 years later.
Well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because, yes, war crimes, certainly, if lies have been used to start a war, which is illegal anyway, you know, how comes people aren't being brought to justice?
Well, there is no justice, unfortunately, currently.
And so what do you feel, I mean, as an activist, you can do in that situation? You're faced with a situation where the justice system, the International Criminal Court, or the courts in this country aren't acting. What can you as an activist do?
Well, people have to stand up. If the courts aren't acting and there is no rule of law on an international level, then it's up to people to stand up together to try and do something about that.
Okay. What made you then, convinced you to go over to Israel? I should call it Israel-Palestine, because officially it's still, a lot of it is occupied territory. Territory which is Palestinian territory occupied by the Israeli state.
Very much so. Almost the entirety of the West Bank is occupied. It is all occupied. Even the areas where Israel isn't allowed to go under international law, what they call Area A, you still see military jeeps and a presence there, even in quite regularly, yeah.
I mean, surely, back in, I think it's 1947, the State of Israel was created. But it was created with this sort of checkerboard of little bits of Palestine, little bits of the State of Israel. I mean, would you admit that really it was never going to work to have one country which is, you know, sort of scattered across a wide area, little bits here and there?
Well, it's ridiculous what they've done to what they call the West Bank. The Palestinian territories are just cut up with illegal settlements. People have to go much further around to find their way to work, or there are so many difficulties with these gated communities, defended. They're cities, actually. They're massive. Some of these settlements are absolutely huge.
Well, tell us what it's like over there, because many of us have never actually been there. You're saying it's like little cities.
Yeah, I only got a very brief chance to visit the settlements. I was visiting the other side, and the settlements are modern cities, like some of them. They're big, and Palestine is like a much... The bits that are still Palestine is much poorer, and there's watchtowers, there's checkpoints, there's military... I guess checkpoints again, but there's the military just cut up the land.
But surely you can understand that, because there is this low-level aggression going on, you know, both sides. But, I mean, the Israelis have got the resources to put in some barriers for to separate the two communities, a little bit like, say, in Northern Ireland.
Well, they have a massive military might. And from what I've seen, the Palestinians have stones as their only way to resist the, like, one of the biggest, strongest armies on the planet.
Well, you say that, but they've also got rockets, and we hear from time to time more rockets have been being fired into Israel from the Palestinian side, don't we?
Well, I was actually in the West Bank, which they don't have rockets, and the Gaza Strip does fire really low level rockets, but this is often in retaliation to things like during the last Gaza massacre. There were many events before the rockets were fired that led up to that, like a young lad who was playing football was shot by a military helicopter. And then, of course, the Gaza Strip resists to some extent with what they have, which is homemade rockets and low-level rockets. And then the response from the Israeli military is to drop bombs on highly, really densely populated bits of land, killing many, many innocent women and children, and it's just disgusting, really.
So did you go off your own bat, or did you go as part of a group over there?
I went entirely off my own back. I went to join the International Solidarity Movement. I had originally actually planned to be out there for about 5 months, and that's how it turned out to be in the end. The ISM support the Palestinian struggle, basically, and their entirely legal aim.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
of
you know,
a state.
Yeah, but you're talking about the settlements. I mean, surely, you know, this is actually Israeli land, and they're building, you know, as we do here. They're, you know, housing developers are coming in to build places for people to live, because, you know, just like here in Britain, you know, we have a housing shortage. So surely they're doing the same sort of thing over there. They're building houses for their people.
International law really clearly divided the country into two countries. Israel is constantly expanding these illegal settlements. That are completely illegal under international law. They're expanding
these.
So
why are they illegal when you say illegal?
So many different methods of kicking people off the land. First, they attack people. The settlers attack. The soldiers attack people. They then have to go through the so-called Israeli legal system, which bans people from their land while the settlement further encroaches. It's disgusting the way they carve the land up. They say they're going to take, like, one dunam of land, which is something less than a square kilometre. They say they're going to take that, but to secure that bit of land, they make a firing zone of like 50 or sometimes 100 dunams of land, where if the Palestinians go to work that land with their sheep or with their goats, they get shot at. Sometimes with like riot control.
Well, vehicles of some sort. But what about this whole idea of them being illegal? Surely this is Israel's territory. They can do what they want.
Israel has already taken a massive part of what formerly was Palestine, and they're further encroaching always into people's land and doing it in a horrible and violent manner.
Okay, so how, you know, you were there for 5 months. What were you doing for most of that time before you got arrested?
Okay, I was working with the International Solidarity Movement. I first went out there actually to join the olive harvest. So we joined the farmers who are often closest to the illegal settlements, so they can pick their olives with some more feeling that they will be safe, because the settlers often attack people while they're working their fields. They burn the olive trees, they attack people.
And why do they do that?
Israel is consistently is pushing people further and further away from these settlements as these settlements expand.
But I mean, it sounds incredible that, you know, the idea that, say, an Israeli settler might decide, well, even though that's my neighbour's land, I'm going to push them away from it. I mean, why would they
do
that?
It does sound crazy, and it is crazy, actually. It's completely crazy. I think different settlers have slightly different motivations. There's some who are economic settlers. There's others who are, like, fundamentalist religious settlers. And they attack with the motivation basically to expand the state of Israel for one reason or another.
The funny thing is there's this whole talk about the right to return, isn't there? This is one of the things that a lot of the Israelis say is, we've got in the Bible a right to return to this land. Well, hang on a minute. You know, this is like thousands and thousands of years ago. And what about the right of the Palestinians to return to the land that they still have the deeds to, that they had, you know, maybe a few years ago? I find that one of the most weirdest things about the whole Israeli-Palestine conflict. But anyway, Tom, tell us how you came to actually be arrested. I mean, what happened?
Okay, I was attending a weekly demonstration in the village of Kufa Kadum. ISM attends a lot of demonstrations. We're often invited because over time, there's been some sort of proven record that we can de-escalate violence with our presence in some situations. So we attended one of the demonstrations in Kufa Kadum.
Well, hang on a minute, because I'm suddenly thinking, well, actually, you might actually increase tension by having a demonstration in the face of the Israelis.
Okay, well, of course, the Palestinians are having a demonstration in the face of the Israelis. We don't. As internationals, we can't go there and say, let's have a demonstration. Of course, we turn up to other people's demonstrations where we're invited.
Okay, no rocket launches, nothing like that at these demonstrations?
Are they absolutely peaceful? No rocket launches at these demonstrations.
Okay, peaceful demonstrations. So you just go along to sort of, I suppose, be a witness and maybe, you know, sort of be there with the Palestinians.
It is really, we witness, that's the main thing we do, we witness. We're a non-violent group, so we don't ever take part whatsoever in any of the clashes, the stone throwing, and we're there as witnesses. And to some extent, we have seen the usage of live ammunition at these demonstrations drop because of international presence and an Israeli presence as well.
Hang on a minute, because I mean, it sounds to me like you're almost putting yourself in the line of fire there, Tom. You know, what would motivate you to actually stand there whilst the Israelis may be pointing a gun and cocking a gun at you?
It seems strange, but it's just to stand with people. It's when you're there, it's so obvious. It really, really obvious what the problems are and the fact that something needs to change. The Palestinians, a lot of them are really peaceful people, but they're forced to resist. You cannot watch your land be taken violently, and you have to do something, and usually that comes out now in non-violent resistance. Sometimes there is stone throwing or clashes.
Okay, so yes, carry on, tell us about how you actually came to be arrested.
Okay, well, the village of Kufa Kadum has been cut off by the settlement, which is called Kedamin. And we walked down the road from Kufa Kadum, trying to access the road to Nablus and Ramallah, which has now been blocked by the settlement every week. And usually we get tear gas, and occasionally we get rubber bullets.
So are you saying that actually there's some sort of housing development in the middle of the road, or what?
There is a housing development bang in the middle of the road. It's eating up the villagers' land, and it's stopping access for them to get to cities easily. There is a way around, but it's a long way around.
Okay, so what happened?
Okay, as we walked down the road, we were attacked from the front. We ran back towards the village, and at that point, border police, actually, which you would not be able to distinguish from a soldier to begin with, but they actually came out from the side. And they picked off some of us. They picked up.
So when you say attacked, how exactly?
They, as we were running back, they came down and they picked off three people out of a group of maybe 50.
What, just by grabbing people, throwing things?
They grabbed people. Two of them, for each person that was arrested, two border police came and they sort of jumped on you.
And why were you not supposed to be there? What was the problem exactly?
Police accused me of two things. They accused me of both being at an illegal demonstration, which may be true in their legal system, and they also accused me of throwing stones.
Right, and were you throwing stones?
I absolutely wasn't throwing stones. I went to a court case, actually, the following day in Jerusalem.
But what was it like being arrested and being taken into custody?
Okay, this was pretty grim, actually. I was beaten around the back of the head, I'm told, by the butt of a rifle, although it could have been anything. I developed a big bruise on the back of my head, a big lump. I was punched in the face twice. I had my head slammed into like a bulldozer that moves barricades from the front of the demonstration. My head was slammed into that. And then not long after that, I was taken into Kedamin, into the settlement, where I was blindfolded. The three of us that were arrested, myself and two Palestinians, Bilal and Naif, were put against a wall, blindfolded, hooded, made to look at the ground as the Israeli army loaded their rifles or something like that.
As they loaded their rifles, so you could actually hear the sound of them?
I could hear the sound of loading weapons, probably rifles, maybe tear gas guns. I'm no expert.
So what was going through your mind?
Well, my leg was uncontrollably shaking. There was a brief moment where I thought maybe I wouldn't get out of this situation alive. I soon gathered myself though, really, and realised that this was some sort of mock execution, although I was literally terrified for some time.
So you can't see what's happening, but all you can do is hear soldiers loading weapons of some sort.
They'd been screaming at me, they'd already given me a black eye, I already had a bruise on the back of my head. I wasn't feeling too great, no.
Okay, so how did you spend the night?
They took me to various different prisons, actually, in police stations. The first place they took me to was Ariel Police Station. At Ariel, they kept us all together and kept us under supervision, probably because of the fact they'd beaten us. They'd beaten one Palestinian, Bilal, around the back of the head with a stone. So they monitored us for the first several hours, I'm not sure.
All right, so you found yourself in court. At last, you got a chance to defend yourself. Did you have a lawyer?
I did have a lawyer. The judge said, the police actually said that I was accused of throwing stones. The judge said, you're going to have to give me some proof. Do you have a video? The policeman said, yes. The judge said, come back, I'll give you 12 hours for you to prove that he had stones with a video or a photograph. And during that 12 hours, I was taken then towards Tel Aviv, where I was transferred into the hands of the Shabak, which are like internal, sort of some sort of group like MI5, and internal,
sort of
quite
secret
serious police force, yeah.
That's sort of secret police, basically.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay, so did this video ever get produced?
The video never got produced. I was taken to immigration, basically, when the Shabak dealt with me. They interrogated me and put me through the immigration system.
Well, when you say interrogated, was that fairly light or quite tough interrogation?
It was a very different interrogation. They placed me, they sat me on a chair without handcuffs, looking at a bag of my possessions for like several hours, which sort of, I don't know, it does something to you when you've already been held for like 2 days by this point. They made you look at your telephone. I'm a smoker, so my cigarettes, things that you would want if you'd been detained for two days. So they played a little mind trick until I got angry, and then that showed my political stance probably by the time they worked me up, if you like.
So, I mean, was there one person interrogating you, two people? What was it like?
There were several people in like an office, just like a standard office, but they treat me like it was just a really strange interrogation, nothing like anything you would expect.
What kind of questioning?
They were trying to provoke, like I say, they were trying to provoke emotion in me. And they did name drop people involved with the ISM, and they were trying to provoke emotion on the subject of Palestine and Israel, really, and it, and then they threatened me with like names of my family, which was, I found, very strange.
Well, how did they get hold of that?
I'm not entirely sure. Maybe at the border or something. They were like, your family will pay, and things like that.
Did they actually know your names of people in your family?
I'm not sure they did, actually. They said they started threatening me with my family.
All right. So how long were you actually in custody for altogether?
I was held for an entirety of 11 days, and then the final day was like a transfer to the airport, and then I then got interrogated for a final time by British Special Branch.
Okay, so they were, I mean, were they fairly, I mean, you would have thought that once you've been in the hands of foreign authorities and you've been handed over to, I mean, Special Branch, which is connected with the British MI5, the Secret Intelligence Service here in Britain, the Internal Security Service, hopefully, once you've been handed to them, it was a little bit more of a friendly form of interrogation, if you can call it that?
Well, they stop you in Heathrow with no right to silence and no right to a legal representative.
So this was once you got back to Britain, you were stopped.
This is in Heathrow, yeah.
So after what I'd happened? Gone through customs and the passports, or what?
When
stage?
I'd gone through the passports before customs, okay. They immediately started to follow as soon as I went through the passport scan. They obviously got that from my name from the passports. I decided I didn't want to cooperate. I made some sort of a stance not to cooperate.
Why is that?
Because they're stopping non-violent activists under the Terrorism Act. I think this is outrageous.
So how do you know that we stopped you under the Terrorism Act?
They stopped me under Schedule 7 of the Terrorism Act 2000. They showed me these documents, and I contested that this was should it's misuse of police powers, in my opinion, because there is no chance they had any reasonable suspicion that I could have been linked to terrorism.
Okay, so how did it feel once you'd, you know, how did that go, that little session with Special Branch at Heathrow?
Okay, it didn't turn out too bad in the end. They, after an hour of contesting that I wasn't going to cooperate, they said, we know what you've been through, we know you've been arrested. If you just tell us about the arrest, which I'd already spoken to the Foreign Office about and made a complaint about, we'll let you go by midnight. So I cooperated and talked about my arrest, which is nothing that I hadn't said before anyway, so it's not a problem.
Oh, I mean, and so was it, what time did you actually manage to set foot on British soil without being interrogated, arrested or anything else? When were you actually freed, you know, in Britain?
It was the very early hours of the 12th of March.
And how did it feel to actually be finally, you know, able to do what you wanted to do?
It felt good, actually.
And could you actually get anywhere from Heathrow with the tube train still running? Or
thankfully, some Palestine solidarity activists came to meet me and drove me back to Bristol.
Oh, fantastic! Okay, overall, do you think it was worthwhile? I mean, you know, it sounds like a pretty grueling thing to have gone through, Tom.
To be honest, my story is nothing when you've been in Palestine for 5 months. Some of the stories that I had to witness over there were tragic, really, and my story really was kind of good. I came out alive.
And would you go back?
I would definitely like to go back, but I am banned for 10 years.
Okay, well, Tom Woodhead, thanks ever so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
And I will go that way. The future is bright.
from 1999. A long time ago, that, isn't it? Ouija Records. That is Detour, and it's on an album which is called Social Dancing from a Scottish group. I'm not quite sure, Edinburgh or Glasgow, somewhere like that, called BIS. B-I-S. Excellent little record. Not very well known about. And I'm joined now by Dennis from Bristol Animal Rights Collective. Hi, Dennis, and welcome to Dialect.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
Now, just tell us a bit about its bark, B-A-R-C. What is bark?
Well, bark stands for Bristol Animal Rights Collective. We're a local animal liberation group, and our aims is to end the exploitation and use of animals for human needs.
But I mean, what about things like horses? You know, in the old days, people used to use horses, didn't they? So, is that the sort of, would you be against that as well?
Well, I think we're seeing a modern age today where the sort of use of horses for sort of like labour and agriculture are not necessary. Modern technology allows for these sort of practices to become what they are, historic means. And so we're against all forms of animal use which benefits humans and not animals.
Well, what about, say, just, you know, say if I want to keep a horse and ride it around the countryside?
Well, in a way, we see that as necessarily you're doing that for your own benefit and not, maybe not necessarily the benefit of the horse. We believe that animals have their own intrinsic value, which isn't necessarily defined by their usefulness to humans.
Yeah, well, while we're on the subject of horses, I think it's almost a gift to the animal rights movement, isn't it? This whole business with horse meat over the last couple of months. I mean, how have you received it as an animal rights person yourself? I mean, probably just saying, well, we told you so.
Well, I think it's definitely sort of as you expect from sort of the society we live in, where businesses are trying to make the most amount of money possible, they will just cut corners. And one of those obvious symptoms of that is putting horse meat into practically everything we eat nowadays. I mean, and obviously I'd like to state that as an animal rights group, we believe that animals should not be consumed for humans. So to us, it doesn't make a difference whether you're eating horse or cow or pig or chicken. We see that as unnecessary. But yeah, as you state, that it's, yeah, a gift from God almost.
Well, how about the horse meat? I mean, the whole sort of horse meat industry and the animal industry is hidden behind this kind of wall of secrecy, which is called an abattoir. I mean, basically, you know, nobody knows really what goes on unless somebody like yourself or someone from an organisation which is sympathetic to animals is going to go in and film it secretly, because they just don't let people in.
I think that's very true. I mean, animal industries go to a very long way to hide the practices that go on inside their businesses, and this is not just limited to abattoirs and slaughterhouses. Animal testing and other forms of animal industry are hidden behind closed doors at all times. I mean, there's a famous quote from John Lennon which said that if slaughterhouses had glass walls, then everyone would be vegetarian, and we believe this to be true. And there's an obvious reason for this, because if people were faced with what their food actually entails, that is the wholesale slaughter of animals, then they too would probably make the change to go vegetarian or vegan.
Well, for most people, I mean, when it comes to buying meat, they're presented with a sort of styrofoam white thing in a supermarket with a bit of cellophane across it. They don't really see what goes on. I mean, what do you know about what goes on behind the slaughterhouse door?
Well, I mean, slaughterhouses are obvious places of extreme torture and, well, murder, to be frank. I mean, animals are put through horrific lives where they're raised from birth for purely for human consumption, and they will never see the light of day or feel most of the time the grass under their feet, and they'll have short lifespans, and they'll be raised intensively to produce the maximum amount of meat, which will then end up ultimately being shipped off to the slaughterhouses where they can face inhumane treatment and ultimately death.
I mean, if you had your way, Dennis, we wouldn't have any fields with any sheep in or cows. I mean, in those animals, what you're saying in a way means that actually, we don't want any of these creatures in the countryside at all. They wouldn't even be alive if it wasn't for the meat industry.
I think that is a sort of a straw man argument, almost, to say that these animals wouldn't exist if they weren't here for human consumption. I mean, there are lots of animals and they all exist for their own purpose. We believe that animals should be allowed to their own devices to be able to do what they were naturally intended to do, and that is not to live in slaughterhouses and factory farms where they're reared for human consumption. I mean, we obviously know that these animals were bred specifically for the animal industry, but we don't believe necessarily that we want to get rid of animals. We just want all animals to have the freedom to live their life as nature intended.
But surely that's the consequence of what you're saying. I mean, ultimately it would mean that most of our land would be going over to, you know, sort of the arable agriculture, growing plants, you know, like corn and things like that. It wouldn't be used for animals at all, livestock. So, you know, where would these animals, what are you saying, would they would just run around free? Cows would be kind of hiding in the woods and that kind of thing?
I mean, I might like to make a point first where you're saying about all our land would be used for arable agriculture. It's a matter of fact that the majority of grain and other sort of agricultural crops at the moment are being fed to animals in slaughterhouses to feed us. I mean, it's a shocking fact that like 90% of the soya, which is a common argument used against vegans, is fed to livestock in order to produce beef. So we believe that at the moment we probably do have the resources to feed everybody. It's just that the majority of them are being fed to animals. And I believe that, well, obviously if there is some sort of mass liberation where all animals are freed from that, from captivity, we will have a period of where we'll have animals roaming everywhere, but nature has a way of fixing itself, and we believe that eventually numbers will stabilise and we'll start to see a return to normality.
But I mean, you know, normality surely right since the days of the cavemen has been you know, that humans do eat animals. They go out hunt them, they're hunter-gatherers, that's what they used to do. They go out and spear an animal.
I mean, that may be true, but the fact is that we aren't living in the Stone Age anymore, and there are lots of other practices from that age which we now see as horrific, sort of things as sort of racism and rape and brutality and murder, all things that we believe now in modern society are wrong. And I see eventually we will maybe move towards a society where we view the killing of another animal purely for the benefit of our own needs to be wrong as well.
Okay, now you talked about animal liberation earlier. This is a term I like the sound of, and it sounds great, you know, that the animal's free, particularly when you're talking about an experimentation on animals. So what are your thoughts about that? I mean, I must admit, my feelings are that there are, you know, some pretty cruel things going on, again, not just behind the abattoir doors, but also in these experimental labs. So is that one of the things that motivates you?
Oh, entirely. I mean, Bristol Animal Rights Collective and myself personally are completely against animal testing, or what's known as vivisection. We believe that animals, as again, should not be used for human needs to test cosmetics or to test medicine or to test floor cleaner or pesticides or whatever they're used for in these labs where they're subject to horrific torture and cruelty.
Now, what about, I mean, would you be prepared to go into a lab and actually liberate those animals to get them out?
I mean, myself personally, I don't think I would be able to have the nerve and courage that some people do to break into these places of torture and liberate these animals.
But it does happen, doesn't it? And I mean, you know, the animal rights movement as a whole, of which you're one person and one organisation, has got this reputation, hasn't it, for being quite violent.
Violence is a funny word. I mean, sort of, it really depends on your definition of violence. I mean, my personal definition of violence would be somebody or some person who enacts a physical act against another living being. And if we look at violence in that term, then the animal industry is the massive most, probably the most biggest perpetrator of violence. I mean, it's killing animals in the billions every year. And I mean, the fact of the matter that people are resorting to this so-called violence to liberate animals just goes to show how serious this issue is, and just goes to show how much passion the people within the animal liberation movement are willing to put into freeing these animals, because it's something they truly believe in.
But I mean, you know, go back to the sort of caveman thing. I'm surely violence is something which has always been with us as humans. I mean, you know, back in the Second World War, Hitler was using violence against people. I mean, unless we use violence back against him, we would be a Nazi country now.
Exactly, and I think sometimes violence can be justified, and I think that it's important to realise that violence against property and violence against people is sometimes a completely different thing. And I do not advocate for any sort of violence against any living being. That's part of why I'm an animal liberationist, and that's part of why I'm being a vegan, because I believe that humans and animals should be free to have a life free from suffering.
But do you think it's ever really going to happen? You're going to see it in your lifetime?
I think that's a completely, I wouldn't be able to tell you, to be honest. I mean, we've seen loads of massive shifts and changes in terms of our society. I mean, we're seeing a rise in the number of vegetarians and vegans, and then we're seeing revolutions in countries like Egypt and Tunisia. I mean, it's possible that a new world could come out of this, but whether or not that's one that is exactly what I want to see is a completely different question.
Well, it may come through necessity, maybe. I mean, if we decide that we have to feed everybody in this country, that we're having problems feeding people, then you do have to go over to a much more, arable type of agriculture, because it produces more food in that way. And actually, producing meat is a very inefficient way of producing food. So, you know, maybe we'll be forced down the road of people being more vegetarian, maybe, you know, by degrees, we'll see. But anyway, back to the horses and the horse meat business. Do you think you're vegan. I mean, you have to decide on the labels whether you're actually going to buy something and eat it. Do you think that you're actually getting vegan food when you buy vegan food? Because this horse meat scandal is suggesting that for a lot of people that thought they were eating beef burgers, they weren't.
I mean, that is a very big scare to the majority of the population. I mean, nobody wants to go into the supermarket and buy something that says beef and end up with a load of horse. And I mean, even when I go in and look now, when I go and look for my veggie burger or my vegan burger, whatever, I am starting to begin to wonder, does this have horse in it? And I think that might be the next stage of the scandal, is when we start to discover that all these products, which were claimed to be meat-free, now contain some sort of meat, whether or not it is horse or pork or beef or whatever.
So why is that? I mean, you know, you would think that if something's being labelled as one thing, it would be that. Why is it?
I think what's interesting to look at is the majority of these products which have been shown to contain horse meat as at the bottom end of this, what we'd like to call the bargain sort of meat products. And I think it is largely to make profit, is because the horse meat industry allows for cheaper produce to be bought, i.e. horse meat is cheaper than beef, and it can be put into these burgers, which can then be sold for cheaper and make more profit.
Okay, before we get totally off the subject of horses, I know just before we came on the air, you were talking about the Grand National. What happened there, and why are animal rights people concerned about that?
Well, the Grand National is a yearly event which we are against, obviously, because we believe that horse racing is another exploitative form of animal abuse. And what's also interesting to note is that the Pete Bodie slaughterhouse in West Yorkshire, which was a slaughterhouse which was investigated as part of the horse meat scandal, had a contract with Aintree Racecourses to remove all the killed horses, ones that were killed during the Grand National, to take to their slaughterhouse. So it's a question of whether are these horses that we're betting on in the Grand National, are they then ending up in our burgers in our supermarkets?
Crikey. Well, okay. Tell us a bit about Bark and what you're up to then, Bristol Animal Rights Collective, over the next few months, weeks, whatever.
Well, Bristol Animal Rights Collective, our main aims is to promote animal liberation and veganism, and we do this through numerous different ways, through protests and street stalls and information evenings. A few dates we've got coming up over the next couple of days, is we've got a demo this Saturday in the centre of town, which is against AstraZeneca, which is a animal testing industry. So that's at 12 p.m. at the Fountains.
So this is a sort of anti-vivisection type?
Against animal testing. It's against the specific company which has recently been in the news to do with animal testing.
And I suppose I should have really asked you, are there any of these laboratories around Bristol?
There are not any specific animal testing laboratories within Bristol. There is a compound belonging to AstraZeneca, which is the company I was mentioning earlier, out in Avonmouth. And the nearest animal testing facility to us is in Hereford, and it's Sequani Limited. And that is our closest animal testing facility.
Sorry I interrupted you. Carry on and tell us about this thing on Saturday.
So on Saturday, people will be meeting at 12 p.m. on the Fountains, and it will be a peaceful protest to demonstrate against AstraZeneca's use of beagles in animal testing. There's been a recent campaign against AstraZeneca after a beagle breeder in Sweden, which was breeding dogs for vivisection, shut down, and all of its stock, that is beagles, was transferred over to a facility in Alderley Edge near Manchester. So basically there's been a long-running campaign to try and free these beagles and save them from the life of vivisection, and this demonstration on Saturday is part of a global campaign to try and free those animals.
Okay, whereabouts can people find you online, and maybe, you know, other ways of contacting you?
Well, we do have a website, which is bristolanimalrights.org.uk. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/Bristol Animal Rights Collective. We also have a Twitter, which is at Bristol Arc, that's Bristol ARC, and we're available on email at bark@hotmail.co.uk.
Okay, brilliant. And just one final question. A lot of people are really disgusted by things like vivisection, but they're not vegans. They may even eat a bit of meat sometimes. Maybe even some people decide, I'm only going to eat organic meat, for example, where the animals have had a bit of a better life. So are they welcome as part of your group, or is it only vegans?
BARC welcomes all people who are struggling for animal liberation, and we believe that maybe not necessarily maybe someone who eats meat or is only just vegetarian, but we would hope that people who come along to our meetings can further discuss that with us, and maybe we can show them the links between animal vivisection and the meat industry and why being vegan is best for the animals in all cases.
Okay, well, Dennis from Bristol Animal Rights Collective, otherwise known as BARC, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, I'm happy to say Jason Yannakopoulos is back again. Jason, where were you last week?
I was actually helping a friend take part in the UWE Students' Union elections.
Okay, so what post were they standing for?
Her name is Hannah Khan. She was standing for Vice President, Societies and Communications. I'm glad to say she was elected.
Oh, well done. And so you were helping her, you were doing some campaigning, were you?
Yeah, so
If anyone out there has got a campaign, they're about to run, then they should contact you and if they want to win.
Yes, definitely. I think so.
Okay, and also, you've brought a copy of Private Eye again, as usual. What have you got for us this week?
Well, this one's quite an interesting one. UNESCO, which I'm sure many of you know what that is.
Well, what does it stand for?
That's the United Nations Educational and Scientific
and Cultural
Organization.
I'm glad you know what UNESCO stands for.
Yeah, it's the they put Liverpool and the World Heritage in danger list after the council gave Peel Holdings a vast 5.5 billion Liverpool Waters Docklands project, which changes Skyland City. Now, the reason I brought this up is it's interesting because on the board overseeing this in Liverpool County, in Liverpool Council, is not only the director of Peel Holdings, a rag trade millionaire, David Wade Smith, but also the Vice Chancellor of Liverpool University, who is a name that would be familiar to many in Bristol, Sir Howard Newby, who is a former Vice Chancellor of UWE.
Oh, okay. So he's gone off up to Liverpool now. Now, why have UNESCO got involved, though?
You know, they got involved because it's an interesting one. There's a lot of historic buildings there, but Liverpool want to knock that down and pave the way for some new flats. And
are they going to actually bulldoze it, or are they going to?
Well, it looks for it. I mean, one of the people on the board suggested that the World Heritage status is just a vanity badge, put it in quotes there.
I mean, what do you think of what's happened around the harbour side in Bristol? Because, I mean, we had quite a lot of historic buildings there that have slowly, one by one, being bulldozed. And some of them are actually, to be fair, being converted, aren't they, into housing?
It is a matter of shame because, you get some people say at least they're not bulldozing the Greenback, but these are massive historical buildings. And yes, it happens, you know. But it is a massive shame when it does happen because you're getting rid of a piece of massive history there. It's interesting that it's gone to a private family based in Liverpool. As I said, I brought up Sir Howard Newby there, who was a former vice chancellor of the University of West of England. Now, he was actually sacked from that position when some of the contracts went to a private firm of which he was a non-executive director during his time as vice chancellor at UWE.
Well, I mean, maybe they were just good firms, Jason.
Well, it was a firm. It was Carson Carter and just happened to be the one that he was a non-executive director of.
Oh, right. And so he was actually sacked. So he's now, I mean, maybe the people in Liverpool didn't know about that. Who knows?
Yeah.
Anyway, just as a complete curveball to throw at you, you know, coming up to April now, 2013, if you go back 50 years, it was April 1963, Beeching Report. Now, it was Dr. Richard Beeching that closed down most of our railways, at least turned it from a viable network that went all the way around the country to something which was really just the commuter routes.
Well, it's interesting been that because I myself came here by train today. So.
Yes, but you see, you came from along a very, you know, high profit margin commuter route. You didn't come along a little branch line, did you?
No.
Well, except I suppose you could call Stapleton Road and Lawrence Hill branch line, since that's our nearest station.
Well, yeah, I mean, I got on the train from Bristol Elizabeth Parkway and got off at Lawrence Hill.
So would you agree with, I mean, maybe I'm being a little bit paranoid, but I think the beaching was responsible for most of the cars that we see parked along our streets today. And, you know, every time I'm in a traffic jam, I think this man, Dr. Beeching, pops into my mind.
Well, yes, I mean, it is an interesting point of view. It's that there certainly was a massive increase in car production after the beaching report was published, so...
Well, and also a massive increase in the amount of oil which was used in Britain. I mean, I know at the time they discovered North Sea oil, and there was Americans apparently were getting a little bit annoyed, saying, well, look, you know, if you produce all this North Sea oil and sell it into the international market in the 1960s, you don't use cars much in Britain. So you have to boost your car use in Britain so that you don't depress the oil price for us in the rest of the world.
And then came the beaching report. So funny that, isn't it?
It's strange. And also, very few people know much about beaching. There's a book just about to come out by someone called Richard Cotterill. Now, he was the Conservative MEP for the southwest of England, and he's calling it Doctor Who. Which is because he's a kind of mystery man. He sort of steps out of the shadows into this very important role in closing down the railways.
Steps like in the shadows.
I mean, he is one of the absolute hate figures of the environmental movement, because a lot of them would put global warming almost fairly and squarely down to him. You know, the fact that there's so much pollution now is largely due to motor cars.
It is interesting because in a little group that I run in my hometown. We have an environmentalist and we also have a railway enthusiast, so you can imagine the stick Dr. Beeching gets from that.
Well, I'll give you a little taster of the book, because he explains in the book, for one of the first times ever, that Beeching was one of the people on the project team for the British atomic bomb in the 1950s.
Oh, wow.
So once he'd finished making atom bombs, he blew up the railways.
Wow, genuinely evil.
Okay, Jason, any more stories from Private Eye?
That is the only one this week which actually really grabbed me, purely because of the involvement of a former vice chancellor of a university in Bristol.
Okay, our local Freemason MP from Filton and Bradley Stoke, Jack Lepresti, you brought him up a couple of weeks ago.
I did,
as doing these little nice little trip in December over to Saudi Arabia. Now it looks like maybe he was sort of helping pave the way for this trip from Charles and Camilla that's happened over the last couple of weeks. But I mean, tell us a bit about Saudi Arabia. What kind of regime is it?
It's an absolute monarchy. The king and prime minister, and I think also foreign secretary, is His Majesty King Abdullah II. You know, so it's an absolute monarchy. It's also a religious, an absolute religious authority. Because of course, he's strongly Muslim, and of course, the whole country runs under Sharia law. And a really extreme version of Sharia law at that. So it's essentially a fundamentalist regime.
Well, they have public executions as well there. I mean, it sounds like almost going back to Victorian times.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah.
makes the Syrians look not quite so bad in some ways.
It's interesting in Syria because a lot of people say that Syria is a similar country, but actually Syria has a large Christian minority. I mean, they still do a lot of things that you wouldn't expect from a Muslim
country. Well, and also, like women are allowed to drive cars, for example.
Women are allowed to drive cars. They're allowed to brew beer. I mean, it is. I mean, the beer is particularly traditional ancient Syria. Because, of course, don't forget, for a long time it was part of the Roman Empire.
Okay, Jason Yannakopoulos, thanks ever so much. See you again next week.
See you next week.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
And I'm joined now by Paul Fernie. Hi, Paul, again.
Hi there, Tony. How are you?
Now, you've come to develop this whole sort of thing to do with looking up in the sky at night. What's behind meteorites? Because we've heard this thing recently in Russia. Quite an amazing phenomenon.
Yeah, absolutely. Chelyabinsk in Russia recently there was a meteorite went overhead. Just a little bit on
Are you sure it was a meteorite?
Yes.
It wasn't some sort of space capsule coming in, re-entering or something like that?
No. Yeah, I don't think we need to go down that one. No, it's they found plenty of evidence it was a meteorite. meteorite. You know, scientists have been on it, examining the material that they've found.
So have they actually found bits of it on the ground? Did it all burn up?
Yes, they've found by a local lake near to Chelyabinsk, they found 53 pieces of meteorite, quite large pieces. I mean, this meteorite was absolutely massive. Most of the time when you see a meteorite in the night sky, a shooting star, these things are the size of an apple seed. So to get one so massive is quite a rare occurrence. And I mean, just to put it in perspective, estimates of between 1,000 tons and 10,000 tons of material from space lands on Earth every day.
Oh, right.
Which is a fair old amount of material. Obviously, the biggest thing is there aren't that many, you know, the populated areas of the planet are a lot smaller than those that are unpopulated. You know, 70% is ocean, so we don't see a lot of what comes in.
But with shooting stars, is there a better time of the year to see them? Do they come in waves, or is there a particular part of the sky?
Yeah, there are quite a few meteor showers through the year. There's the Geminoids, which come round about September, I believe.
Right, so you know, this is kind of as the Earth goes around the Sun, at least that's what we believe in the modern world. As we go around the Sun, at certain points there are more meteors around than others. Yeah,
basically, a lot of the meteor showers are caused by the dust that's left behind by comets as they travel through the solar system, and the Earth passes through these streams at certain periods.
So what are they, rock?
They're generally just pieces of material. I mean, meteorites come in all sorts of forms.
What substance? You know, what kind of thing? Is it a bit of rock? Is it a bit of metal or what?
Generally, the majority are what they call stony meteorites, which are rocky silicates. Then you get your iron meteorites, which are mainly iron and nickel. And you get stony ions, which are a mix. And the different materials, it's all left over from the formation of the solar system.
The Big Bang.
Not the Big Bang, that was a bit earlier.
Okay.
But no, the formation of the solar system about 4.7 billion years ago, that's the material that's left behind.
And so the Chelyabinsk one, I mean, is that likely to be from, say, from further outside the solar system, or has that just been floating around the Sun and we just so happened after a million years or something, we collided with it?
Absolutely, and that's as simple as that. You know, this thing's been floating around out in the...
So it didn't quite make it to be a moon or a planet?
No, basically that's it. I mean, there's the asteroid field, which is between Mars and Jupiter. That's full of material, and this stuff periodically falls in towards the Sun, and occasionally Earth gets in the way.
Okay. What about actually finding these meteorites? You mentioned that there's certain times of the year. How do we know when to look for them?
Well, I mean, the stuff that we see as meteor showers or shooting stars, it doesn't never reaches Earth. You know, these are tiny, like I say, the size of an apple seed. They burn up and they're gone. The biggest stuff, like at Chelyabinsk, basically, I mean, if you see one of these things shooting across the sky, the chances are it's about 50 miles above you when this is going on. Plus, when it's about 5 to 12 miles above the Earth, it goes into what's called a dark phase, where it doesn't actually have any visible signs that it's there. It's just rocketing through the sky. So you've got to be pretty good to actually find pieces of meteorite. Most meteorite hunters, people who make a living out of finding this stuff, they go out to deserts and places like this, and they spend the whole life searching for this material.
But what about really big ones? Have we got any big meteorites heading towards the Earth right now?
Not that I'm aware of. nothing that I've seen in the news or anything. However, at the moment, there is a comet you can see at the moment,
right.
Which is the, to give it its full name, C/2011 L4 Pan-STARRS. Which is in the west in the early evening, just after sunset.
And what does it look like? How do you pick it out?
It basically appears as sort of a misty point of light. It has got a fair tail on it, but it's on its journey back out of the solar system. By the way, if you don't see it now, don't hold your hopes up. This is on a 100,000-year orbit, so we're not going to see it again in our lifetimes.
Christy.
It's on its journey back out to the Oort cloud.
Okay, Paul, if you'd just like to wind up by giving us some good resources to go online to look for these sort of things.
Yeah, a great resource is the SOHO website, which is the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory. It's a NASA website. it has fantastic images of comets as they approach the sun, and also some other great images of solar flares and stuff like that. Also great images available all over the internet, and if you want more on Pan-STARRS, if you search Pan-STARRS in your favourite search engine, again, you'll find loads of resources on that.
Okay, Paul Fernie, thanks very much. No, Jeff and his What's On next week. He's preparing something special for us next week. So that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or our email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol, 0117 989 7733. You'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That number again, 0117 989 7733. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. So thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye. Let me know that it's real. You're just too good.